Good morning and welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the five leading causes of death among men in 2011, the last year for which such stats have been published, were coronary artery disease, cancer, generally prostate, lung, and colorectal cancer, accidental death, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and stroke. And yet, if you peruse various magazines, websites, and commercials targeted to men regarding their health, you would assume erectile dysfunction was the greatest threat to mankind. Today on the program, we will turn our attention to the medical issues that really should be top of mind for men, and we'll welcome your general men's health questions for Dr. Sumukh Sundaram, an MD from Christie Clinic specializing in internal medicine. We do these shows from time to time as a public service. On past programs, we've turned our attention to women's health and children's health. This time, we welcome questions you have for yourself or a man in your life, and along the way, we'll also discuss things you or the men in your life can do to screen for and seek to prevent those medical conditions that genuinely threaten men's lives. We'll also discuss the role of proper exercise and diet, and if there's time, we will address those ED ads. We welcome your men's health questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or find us and comment or send your questions to Facebook or Twitter. Focus now has its own Facebook and Twitter pages. You can find us on both social networking sites at Focus 580. That's Focus 580. And again, our phone numbers are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Dr. Sundaram, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, Brian.
Glad to have you along with us. What should be the top health concerns of men today?
Top concerns for men would be coronary artery disease, which is still the leading cause of death, and obviously cancer, mostly prostate, colorectal, and lung cancer, chronic obstructive lung disease and associated infections, accidental deaths, which are surprisingly higher on the list than diabetes or Alzheimer's or kidney disease, and of course, stroke.
So let's talk about each of these major causes of death among men and what we could do to maybe screen for them or seek to prevent them. Let's start with cancer, and specifically prostate cancer. That's something that someone in my family was dealing with not too long ago, and it's something that I guess is relatively prevalent among men.
It is relatively prevalent. It's obviously a topic of great controversy of late. a couple of things. It is the leading cancer detected in men. There was roughly about 240,000 cases of prostate cancer in 2011. The current recommendations from most major societies is don't screen, but have an informed discussion with your physician. So as men, when you go to see a physician, what should you expect to hear? And this is what my one-minute blurb that I tell usually my patients. Here it goes. Mr. Jones, there is a blood test that can help detect unsuspected prostate cancer. If results are abnormal, I will likely refer you to a urologist who would do a prostate biopsy to determine if cancer is present. If we do a biopsy and it shows cancer, we would recommend treatment either with surgery or radiation. Treatment can be associated with incontinence, impotence, rectal bleeding, and even death. Even if we treat, there is no good evidence that you will live any longer or the treatment will even decrease the likelihood of you dying of prostate cancer. How would you like to proceed? This is what most men should expect to hear, at least from their primary care physicians, when they go in asking for screening for prostate cancer. My general experience has generally been that once patients hear this, many of them do back off wanting to screen, partly because if this is really not going to do you much, quote-unquote, good, so to speak. Of course, the recommendations don't really address those at higher risk with a strong family history and, of course, African-American men in general who are at a slightly higher risk for prostate cancer than average. There's constant revisions to these guidelines, but this is what I normally tell my patients, especially in their 60s and 70s. And many of them do opt out of screening, but there is also a significant portion of patients, maybe about 20 or 30%, at least in my practice, who would want to say, I don't want to be that one in 28,000.
Right. Well, let me ask you about another form of cancer that we mentioned at the top. It tends to be among the leading causes of death among men. That's lung cancer. Is that true for women as well, or is this something that is specific to men, that they're at higher risk for it?
Actually, there are some recent studies which have shown that actually cigarette smoking in women puts them, actually, they're more susceptible to get diseases related to smoking, COPD, and lung cancer. But yes, men do tend to smoke more than women, and certainly the leading risk factor for lung cancer is smoking in general. The problem with lung cancer is adequate screening techniques. I think what people have to realize is that a chest X-ray will not diagnose lung cancer. There are some studies. There may be some guidelines coming out, particularly in the high-risk groups, men aged 55 to 74 who have smoked for 30-plus years. There is a role for a what we call like a low-dose CT scan. The problem with the low-dose CT scan is that right now it's not available for general consumption, so to speak. It's mostly available in research centers. The NIH has a study going on to see if there could be some screening guidelines for lung cancer. The problem is the leading cause is by the time you detect it, it's too late. And there are no adequate screening techniques as of yet. And the best way to lower your chances is really to quit smoking. And I think that should be an emphasis for every physician who patient comes in. You need to keep reinforcing, quit smoking, quit smoking.
I imagine that's the case for pretty much any health malady, any of the things that we've already listed, and probably many others.
Absolutely.
That the number one risk factor tends to be smoking.
Absolutely. And I think it's a failure of a physician if they cannot convince a patient to quit smoking. It has to be constant emphasis every visit, and that reinforcement sometimes does help.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're taking your men's health questions on today's show. We do these programs from time to time as a public service. In recent months, we have also devoted programs to women's health and children's health. And today, we welcome questions from men about their health or from women about the health of men in their lives. Our guest is Dr. Sumukh Sundaram, an MD from Christie Clinic in Champaign, who specializes in internal medicine. You can call with your questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or find us and comment on Facebook or Twitter at Focus 580. Again, our phone numbers are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We should also up front reinforce that while Dr. Sundaram can't diagnose cases over the phone, he can provide some general health advice and seek to help you understand the next best steps to take. And with that in mind, let's go first this morning to Charles in Champaign. Hi, Charles. Welcome to the show.
Hello, gentlemen. How you doing?
Well, thanks.
Doctor, I got a question for you. Normally when I go in to get a screening, well, not a screening, I normally just get the basic annual checkup, so to speak, cough, you know, they'll check my lungs or what have you. How can I go about asking him, or what do I say to get a more advanced screening so I can get my cholesterol checked, maybe blood work, and also my prostate check? Thanks.
Thanks for the call.
First of all, how old are you?
Oh, I'm afraid he's already off the line.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
That's all right.
Generally, a physical should include some screening labs, and there are different guidelines depending on what you look at. You need your cholesterol checked starting at the age of 20 every 3 or 5 years. Certainly, if you're at higher risk, if you're older, if you have other health issues like high blood pressure, you should definitely have it checked more often. There's no role for a periodic chest X-ray that doesn't really detect anything at all. The prostate cancer screening, as I just mentioned, your doctor should be telling you the risks and benefits of screening. And then the choice is really up to you as an individual to see if you want to go through the screening and the subsequent testing and potentially if you find something or not. So that's an informed discussion you need to have with your patient. I think the key is really the things which really matter are blood pressure, a screen for diabetes, and screen for cholesterol. Those are some basic things that I would generally do for my patients if they're there. Of course, depending on what age they're in. But
should you assume that your doctor is going to say, oh, it's been 3 years or it's been 5 years, it's time to do blood work? Or should you be proactive and say, you know, I'm going to keep track of this myself and insist the next time I come in for a physical, let's do the blood work, let's find out what my blood sugar, cholesterol, all that is?
Absolutely. I think patients do need to be quite proactive in their health. I mean, your physician sometimes is running between patients and they are supposed to spend time with you, but things do fall, and you, as patients, you must be responsible for your own health to a large extent.
I want to come back to that, to blood sugar, cholesterol, and all of those stats a little bit later in the program, but let's go next to Steve in Will County. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I want to go back over some mention you made about the effect, the response to the screening test for prostate, and then the results of treatment. With respect to screening, is there any other indication other than the PSA, bad PSA, that would indicate for biopsy? In other words, absent any PSA data, when would you biopsy? Second question is, although evidence doesn't show any lifetime benefit for treatment of prostate cancer, that's probably an aggregate or a mean statistic. There must be factors in which case that tell when certain treatments are beneficial and when they are not. Can you comment on that, or better, provide a good reference that has the up-to-date thinking on how we proceed in prostate treatment decisions?
Okay, thanks very much for the question.
First of all, on the information, I believe the American Urological Society has a little section for patients, and I think you can access that online. I don't have the actual website address, but that's something you can definitely access. Now, indications for biopsy, it's kind of controversial. I think different physicians use different ways of when to actually biopsy, and part of that is based on how fast your PSA goes up over years. There are some other things like what they measure, like a free PSA. Those might be one or two indications that might indicate you need a biopsy. Supposing your PSA was, say, 2.4 this year, and all of a sudden next year you checked it, happened to check it, and it bumped up to 6 or 7, that's almost like a doubling of your PSA. And in some centers, they may go ahead and biopsy that. Another indication perhaps for biopsy would be with a digital rectal exam, if you are feeling a hard nodule or something just doesn't seem right in a particular lobe of the prostate. So that might be another indication for biopsy as well. Now, in terms of particular treatment options, it's true. I mean, these are all the CDC gathers these data from centers all over. So these are potentially applicable to men all over. I think prostate cancer when detected is typically, and I'm not a urologist, and perhaps you should talk to your urologist if you do have more concerns, but the options for treatment are either surgery or radiation, and both of them do have risks. I think some of my patients who have undergone treatment will experience some incontinence issues, and it can be a major issue, especially after surgery. Impotence is very common. If you have had radiation, the seeds placed, or rectal bleeding is very common. So I do think the aggregate data is based on men in the U.S. and centers who report to the CDC.
Now, part of the complication with a situation like that, I imagine, is that if you talk to a surgeon, more often than not, the surgeon's going to recommend surgery. When you talk to a radiation oncologist, more often than not, they're going to recommend radiation. So part of the struggle is figuring out, okay, what's going to be best for me in my situation? And there are all sorts of factors, I imagine,
absolutely,
come into play there.
And that's a question you should actually raise with your urologist. I don't believe I'm that qualified to answer that. But, I mean, the aggregate data is based on centers reporting to the CDC.
But what is the role, then, for your personal physician in a situation like that? You're there at the beginning and have identified we may need you to take this PSA test and sort of start the patient down the path. But what other role can you play as that, you know, family doctor, as that physician who knows the patient a little bit better, if not the specifics, the specialty of urology?
True. And I think that the discussion should be the pros and cons of testing. And I think it's, unfortunately, a decision which the patient has to make. I think these bodies which are recommending not screening all have that little thing in the end saying, if your patient wants it, do it, kind of thing. And there are, I mean, I would say the majority of the patients would opt not to screen. But there is a, at least in my practice, 20 to 25% of patients in their 50s and 60s who do not want to be that one in 28,000. Right. So,
well, and again, the issue comes down to if you're diagnosed with something like that, the question is, if you had gone without that diagnosis, would you have carried on with a full life without, you know?
And the assumption is more than likely, yes. You're more than likely to die of a heart attack or COPD or something else than prostate cancer.
So you got that to look forward to. Let's go next to Phil in Decatur. Hi, Phil.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I was wondering, actually, two-part question. I'm originally a cancer survivor. And I'm in my late 50s, and I was wondering, prostate cancer apparently runs in the family, and I was wondering if the treatment that I'd gone for an unrelated cancer a few years ago would have had any effect on whether or not I'd be projected to have, if you've heard anything like statistics like that.
It's kind of difficult to answer the question unless the previous cancer potentially involved maybe radiation to your abdomen or...
So radical chemo, about 4 months' worth of chemo.
I don't think I can answer that question with a lot of confidence, but certainly previous cancers, some cancers do tend to run in families. Some patients have multiple cancers, so... It may be there might be a genetic basis to this. It is possible that your previous chemo may have caused some damage, but usually, I mean, it's radiation that may be responsible for an increased risk of cancer in another site.
Is it generally true that if somebody has had cancer that they are sort of automatically at greater risk for it to recur than someone who's never had cancer? Is it just there's no statistics to back it up one way or the other in such general terms?
Not in general terms, but the feeling about cancer nowadays is you've got to treat each patient individually. Certainly, there are so many specific genes that are being identified, and some of these genes seem to trigger multiple cancers in men and women. There's so many of these genes that are being identified, and it's being your cancer is generally not treated nowadays like you have stage so-and-so, so let's do this kind of thing. It's more a genetic and what you might be susceptible to. So it's being tailored to each individual patient.
Well, the one advantage is now that I've had it, I have a bunch of good doctors who I see regularly, so the likelihood of it going, anything going too long or anything else like that is very slim. I was wondering, though, have you ever heard anything like a strep infection? I was subject to strep infections as a young man. And have you ever heard of anything like a viral infection causing damage, say, to lead later to things like cancer or impotence or anything like that?
Yes, there are a lot of viruses which can. They trigger certain oncogenes, or certain viral infections can trigger your genes to perhaps flare a cancer up. In fact, I believe cervical cancer was initially detected with viral infections and genes like herpes virus and stuff. So, yes, viruses can play a role in cancer.
Okay, good. So I'm not barking up the wrong tree. Very good. I've been having trouble getting that answer, and I appreciate it.
I think it's a sort of a generalization. Certainly viruses have been known to play a role in malignancy, but I don't know your particular situation.
Of course. So, I wouldn't expect it to be that.
But, yes, there is a role for viruses in malignancy.
Okay, thank you, because no one's been able to answer that question, even my doctors, and I wanted to at least check before I pursued it myself. It's more curiosity than anything else.
Yeah, I guess, again, the thing to underscore here is that's a sort of a pretty
general statement.
So your doctors may be looking at it specifically to you, and that might be a different matter.
Right. Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're fielding questions about men's health for Christie Clinic MD and internal medicine specialist Dr. Sumuk Sundaram. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can comment on Facebook or Twitter at Focus580. And we will go next to Chris in Urbana. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my question. I just turned 50, and it seems like the common recommendation for when you turn 50 is to have a colonoscopy. And I was assuming that that was relative to prostate screening, but it sounds as though, from what I've been listening to now, that that can be done via a blood test. So I was wondering, one, why kind of the standard recommendation for a colonoscopy at 50, and two, what's your take on that? Is it something that is worthwhile to do for a screening for other things, or is it related to prostate cancer? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call.
Okay. The current recommendations for colorectal cancer, if you're at average risk, meaning that you do not have a first-degree relative with malignancy diagnosed before the age of 50, is that you start a colonoscopy at the age of 50. Now, there are several ways to do a colon cancer screen. You can do a colonoscopy every 2 years. You can do the stool testing for blood if you don't want to go through the procedure itself every year. You can do a flexible sigmoid, which is looking at a shorter portion of your colon every 5 years. If you're at higher risk, meaning that certainly, as I said, if there's a family history of colon cancer or polyposis, then you would start 10 years before your first-degree relative was diagnosed. Many of these screening are suggested at a certain age, partly based on morbidity and mortality rates and the prevalence of a malignancy. Prostate cancer screening with a blood test, and again, I'm reinforcing, I don't think there is any recommendation that you have to do the blood test. The recommendation is that you have a discussion with your doctor. Your doctor should be telling you the pros and cons of testing, and I think that's an individual choice you may have to make. In terms of whether you want the PSA test or not, I think some general caveats. The problem is the test itself is fraught with certain problems in terms of if your number is less than what is expected for your age, it doesn't prove or disprove anything, unfortunately. If you did have a rectal exam during the exam and you did a PSA later on in the day, your PSA may go up. So a higher PSA by itself also doesn't mean you have cancer. So I think the testing is fraught with problems that you should have that discussion with your doctor about whether you want the test or not. But the screening for colorectal cancer is based on prevalence, and the current recommendation is 50 years.
My guest is Dr. Sumuk Sundaram, an MD from Christie Clinic in Champaign, and we do these shows from time to time as a public service. In recent months, we've devoted programs to women's health and children's health. Today, we are welcoming your questions about men's health, and that's from men about their health or from women about the health of men in their lives. We welcome your questions at 333-9455, 800-222-9455, or will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can post your questions on Facebook or Twitter at Focus580, and we will take more of your calls as well as some emails after a break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're taking your men's health questions on today's show. We do these programs from time to time as a public service. In recent months, we've devoted programs to women's health and children's health. Today, we are welcoming questions from men about their health or from women about the health of men in their lives. Our guest is Dr. Sumuk Sundaram, an MD from Christie Clinic, who specializes in internal medicine. You can call in with your questions right now at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or find us and comment on Facebook or Twitter at Focus580. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And again, I will reinforce that while Dr. Sundaram can't diagnose cases over the phone, he can provide some general health advice and seek to help you understand the next best steps to take. Dr. Sundaram, we talked earlier about the importance of every 3 to 5 years or so screening, doing a blood test, doing some blood work for blood sugar, cholesterol, those kinds of things. And, of course, every time you go in for a physical, you want to check blood pressure. Let's talk about the numbers, the specific numbers. What are you looking for when it comes first with blood pressure? At what point do you say, that's high and that's an issue? And how often do you want to check before you maybe put somebody on blood pressure medication?
A blood pressure should be part of every doctor's visit. I think, unfortunately, it gets left out. But how often should you check your blood pressure? Or when would you start treatment? Treatment is generally, the blood pressure has different stages, stage one, stage two. Generally, we start at stage two, roughly.
And what numbers are we talking about with systolic and diastolic?
Diastolic here, stage one is generally anything more than 140 over 90 up to 160. Stage two is 160 and above.
Okay.
Anything at 140, if someone has a blood pressure or comes into your office and has a blood pressure of 146 over 88, it's generally stage one.
Okay.
And the initial step is always diet and exercise. Diet and exercise combined can lower your blood pressure on average, if you're able to do everything very religiously, anywhere from 5 to 8%. Low salt intake, DASH diet. Low salt intake, I think the recommendations that I generally make for my patients are be careful with processed foods with salt. Pickles, don't add salt on your table, a packet of chips, canned soups, anything with processed concentrated salt. It's pretty much your salt for the whole day.
What about processed meats? Is that the same thing?
Processed meats, too.
Yeah, so your bologna, salami,
yes,
that kind of thing.
To give you an example, a little bag of chips is pretty much your salt for the whole day. Mm-hmm. That's roughly more than 2 grams, roughly. The decision to treat would be certainly in the presence of other coexisting factors. Certainly, if they have diabetes, you want your blood pressure to be much lower. If they have heart issues, then you want the blood pressure to be lower. I generally give my patients, if someone is here for, if never seen a doctor, is there at the age of 40 and has a blood pressure of 140 over 90, as I said, I would give them a trial of 6 to 8 weeks to see if the diet and exercise will get their blood pressure down. How often do they need to check it at home? And that's a subject I don't think there's any strong guidelines. Some people tend to check between 2 and 3 times a day. On average, I would say between once or twice a week, just more common sense than anything else.
Should you check at the same time of day each day? Does that matter?
To some extent, yes, it does. Your blood pressure automatically dips as you go through the night and it revs up during the daytime.
Right.
Certainly for those who smoke, you don't want to be smoking and then wanting to check your blood pressure within half an hour. You want to have a cup of coffee and check your blood pressure. Those things are definitely going to drive your blood pressure up. Consistently, medications. If you have failed religiously salt and diet, then you certainly at that point want to consider medications. So initially is always diet and exercise, absolutely. Blood tests-wise, I don't think there are any strong guidelines, and I think there are lots of studies which have shown whether these tests are good for you or they're not good for you. In general, after the age of 20, generally most people should have a cholesterol checked every 3 or 5 years, and depending on their subsequent risk of, if you get obese, if you have diabetes, if you have a metabolic syndrome, then you would check it more often.
Let's talk about those numbers, HDL and LDL. There's like good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. Is that?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Describe what that means and what numbers you should look for when you get your cholesterol checked.
What numbers you should be looking for are, typically your total cholesterol should be less than 200. Your bad cholesterol is dependent on what else you have. For example, if you're diabetic, your LDL needs to be less than 100. If you've had problems with your heart or anything, or a stroke, your bad cholesterol needs to be less than even 70.
And before we go any further, what does LDL and HDL, what do they stand for?
Low-density lipoprotein.
Gotcha.
And HDL is high-density lipoprotein, which is a good cholesterol.
And that's the one that's like fish oil, that kind of thing that... there are certain foods that you can sort of steer towards that tend to provide.
Saturated fats in general will raise your total cholesterol. Yeah. You want to stay with the polyunsaturated and the monounsaturated fats, so to speak. The good cholesterol, the general recommendation is more than 40 for men and more than 50 for women. Your triglycerides should be less than 150 for
and
the
that's
most
blood
part.
Sugar, right?
The triglycerides.
The triglycerides.
Right, yes.
Okay, so what about blood sugar?
Blood sugar, Anything, the current recommendations are anything less than 100 is normal. 100 to 126 is what is called impaired glucose tolerance, meaning you may have a tendency towards diabetes. If you have a fasting sugar more than 126 on multiple occasions, then likely you have become diabetic at that point.
So now, how, do any of these numbers, is any different for men than for women? Or is it all pretty much the same range?
No, these are what we use for both men and women.
Okay.
And except the good cholesterol has to be a little higher for women than men.
And why is that?
Not really sure.
Okay, fair enough. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there's still time for your men's health questions for Dr. Sumuk Sundaram at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Again, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we have this email. A woman writes in and says, my husband's family has a history of spina bifida and severe back problems. His back is achy and uncomfortable, though he is only 33. Is there anything that we should be doing to make sure that he doesn't have the kinds of issues that his older brothers and father are now experiencing? Is there anything else that we should be keeping an eye out for?
Spina bifida, as in requiring surgery, or...
Doesn't indicate that, just a family history of spina bifida and severe back problems. So, and now this is somebody showing some symptoms of, you know, an achy back.
Achy back. I mean, spina bifida, I'm not obviously an expert in the backs here, but in general, I think you need to be careful with maintain a regular exercise program. Be careful with any heavy lifting. Certainly talk to your doctor about physical therapy options. Talk to your doctor about if you're having any neurological symptoms, a tingling, a numbness, or weakness, to pursue additional testing. Keep your weight down. Those are the general things that I would suggest, that they don't run into any long-term problems.
All right, let's take another call. We have Ray on the line from Effingham. Good morning, Ray.
Hi. My question is about testicular cyst. It's been probably 15 years, and it's gotten larger, and I was just wondering, I don't have any health insurance at the moment, but what I was wondering is, what does it have to be, surgery, or how do you treat cysts? And that's the main question.
Okay.
I'm assuming you mean like a spermatocele, which is a collection of sperm around there. These things are benign, typically do not need to be removed unless they're causing you discomfort in terms of pain. Now, the cyst on the outside, if it's like an epidermoid cyst, those are generally benign growths, and unless they're physically causing you any problems, they do not need to be removed. But again, with some reservation, having not seen the patient.
Okay. Ray, is that helpful?
Yes, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. And again, we have about 15 minutes left or so, and so still some time for your calls at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Again, you can also email us if you prefer at will-talk@illinois.edu or post your questions on Facebook or Twitter at Focus580. We started by talking a little bit about various types of cancer that are more prevalent or a greater risk factor for men in terms of death. We talked a little bit about chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and stroke is on that list. You also mentioned that accidental death is on that list. Why is it that that's a high risk factor for men specifically? Is it that we are more accident prone or do we lead riskier lifestyles? Do we tend to do more physical labor? What's behind that?
The last two that you mentioned, I think we are in more physical jobs and we probably do take more risks than women. I think surprisingly, this is the unintentional injuries or the accidents are higher on the list every year if you look at the CDC guidelines. And just to give you some statistics here, men are more likely to die from a fall. And after adjusting for age, the fatality rate, at least in 2005, 2006, was almost 49% higher for men than women. Of course, male drivers are more often involved in fatal motor vehicle accidents.
Right.
And those are the two or three main things. Falls, fire, and impaired driving, and these tend to be more men than women.
what, if anything, as a doctor, can you do? I mean, certainly when we talk about accidents, we're talking about things that can sometimes happen randomly.
Yes.
But are there other elements that can come into play if someone is dealing with, I don't know, high blood pressure or heart issues or something that might be distracting them, or if they do particularly physical labor and you know that as their doctor, what are some things that you can tell them or suggest to them in terms of their lifestyle that they should think about that might potentially have an impact on whether they're more likely to end up in one of these accidental scenarios?
In terms of falls, the recommendations from the CDC are exercise regularly. Even programs like Tai Chi, the things that improve your strength, improve mm-hmm. your balances, they're very good. Drink only in moderation.
Well, that makes
that's
sense.
Possible.
Right.
You ask your doctor to review all the medicines you're on, both prescription and over-the-counter medicines, to reduce side effects, their interactions. You should have your eyes checked. I mean, often as most patients do forget, you need to have a dental exam a year, you need to have a skin exam once a year, and you need your eyes examined once a year. It's part of your thing. So have your eyes examined once a year, reduce the hazards potentially that you can do at home. These are the things that patients themselves can do, perhaps with their physician, to help minimize some of these things.
One of the things that we hear from physicians all the time is regular exercise is important.
Yes.
What does regular exercise mean for men specifically?
What I normally tell my patients is this. I think there is no one thing which fits everybody. The recommendations from most societies are 150 minutes of moderately intense exercise a week, which means that you need to be able to walk about 2 to 4 miles in like 3 to 4 miles in an hour. So what I tell my patients to do half an hour of brisk walking. A mile in 15 minutes is not tough. I mean, you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And do it half an hour every other day. Maybe you can do both the weekends when you have more time. Also combine this with some kind of strength training, something conditioning your muscles, some minimal weightlifting. Brisk walking is fine. But the key is to do something that you enjoy. And that is where most people, patients, end up in trouble. They join a gym, and then you end up going for the first month, and then you drop out because my knees are hurting, my hips are hurting, my back is hurting. Do things that you enjoy. Swimming, walking, walk in the mall. Get up and keep moving yourself and do some strength training as well. 150 minutes is what's recommended. But you don't expect to achieve that right away, but suddenly you want to achieve that. Any modest activity, every age group is important to be active.
I was just going to ask that. Do you recommend different things for different age groups?
Yes and no. I mean, certainly older patients who are physically not able to do that much, keep yourself up and going. I think do a little bit. The people who have lived the longest have lived healthy lifestyles.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're fielding questions about men's health for Christie Clinic MD and internal medicine specialist Dr. Sumukh Sundaram. We do these shows from time to time as a public service. In recent months, we've devoted programs to women's health and children's health, and today we are welcoming questions from men about their health or from women about the health of men in their lives. We welcome your questions at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I mentioned at the top of the show that you would think from all the commercials out there that erectile dysfunction was some sort of epidemic, that that's the biggest, most important thing facing men in terms of their health. It is, of course, big business for the pharmaceutical world. Are there any health effects to worry about associated with the ED medication that's out there? Anything that people don't know about or that isn't already clear from the endless litany of side effects that they list during the commercials?
I think if you're talking about testosterone replacement, there are a few things that your physician should be doing before you start testosterone replacement. One, there are some studies which have shown that testosterone can increase your risk for prostate cancer. So you probably a screen for that if one is available, yes. testosterone replacement can increase or can worsen sleep apnea, for example, in those patients who have sleep apnea. It can drive your bone marrow to make more cells, so your blood gets too thick, so to speak. So you need to get screened or be aware that your testosterone replacement can cause these problems. I think testosterone replacement, the part of the problem is I think most of patients come in complaining of decreased libido, I'm fatigued all the time, I'm run down all the time, and they assume that testosterone is the end-all or cure-all for this, and it's not, unfortunately. Testosterone replacement should only be done for those patients who are hypogonadal, meaning that they are low in testosterone, not to treat decreased libido, decreased vigor, and those issues. I normally, if someone is coming in with these problems, you remember the time you do your testosterone level is important too. Your physician needs to be aware that it's highest roughly at 8 o'clock in the morning, roughly. So that's when you want to do your testosterone levels. It varies with the day. The natural decline in testosterone as you age, that's a subject of controversy if it needs to be replaced or not. And I don't think there are any consensus answers on that.
We've talked about blood pressure. We've talked about blood sugar and cholesterol. I guess something else that's pretty common to check for when you go in for your physical is how the heart is pumping. What are you doctors listening to when you pull out the stethoscope? And it seems like you spend a lot of time just kind of moving the stethoscope around. And you hear, oh, okay, yeah, all right. What are you listening for?
You're looking at the heart sounds are produced by the closure and of the valves, so to speak. There are basically a set of valves which drive which way the blood pumps between the left and right side of your heart. And we're listening to the heart sounds and to see if there's any turbulence across the flow of valves. We're listening for added sounds, which may indicate whether you have high blood pressure, whether you have congestive heart failure, whether your valves are closing or not properly.
We have an email from Mike who says, two of my fingers sometimes inexplicably become numb and cold and turn yellow as if getting frostbite. This happens when it is cold, but not always, and the rest of the fingers and other hand are fine. Is this Raynaud's syndrome? If so, is it a concern? Do you know what Raynaud's syndrome is?
If it is happening in two fingers, it's unlikely to be Raynaud's. Raynaud's is when your hands are exposed to the cold and the arteries go into a spasm, causing your fingers to turn blue and white. Mm. If it is in a particular set, two fingers alone, that would imply some circulation issue. Your physician should probably be checking the pulse in both arms. Your physician should probably be checking the blood pressure in both arms and making sure they're not listening to any whoosh-whoosh noises up in your neck or below your clavicle.
What are some of the things that could lead to poor circulation just in a couple of fingers? Is that like maybe sprain or something could do that?
This is likely to be a circulation problem of one of the vessels coming off the heart or underneath your thing. So two fingers turning yellow and blue is somewhat unusual to be Raynaud's. Usually it's a very rather generalized phenomenon.
Okay. And we have this question. I have a younger brother who is 21. As a woman, I was told to start getting a yearly physical when I was 18, but my brother has not been to the doctor or gotten a physical since he was in high school. Should young men get yearly physicals? At what age should they start getting one?
Young men should. I believe, as I said, at 20, it's reasonable. And in that age group, as I said, they probably do not need to see a physician often, but the screening would involve essentially checking for cholesterol and screening for sexually transmitted diseases, making sure safe driving practices. Those are the things that we generally would suggest. But yes, physical at 20 is reasonable. But at the same time, he doesn't have to probably do it every year if he's otherwise maintaining an active health lifestyle, so to speak.
We talked earlier about how there are times when you need to be proactive with your doctor. If for no other reason, your doctor may be very busy, you know, bouncing around from one patient to another. That's just the reality of the world we live in.
Absolutely.
When you have the time to sit down and talk with patients, and I imagine you try and make the time whenever you can to talk as much as you can with them, what are some of the just general questions that you ask of patients, and what are some of the things that you wish patients would walk in the door ready to tell you?
I mean, patients, when we do a physical, it's generally going through their history, their surgical history. Particularly for someone who's new to the office or the practice, you're more interested in the family history to make sure that they don't need to be screened for anything at an earlier age or not. And you will certainly want to make sure about substance abuse, about alcohol use, about tobacco history, smoking history. Those are the general things that we ask for, and the exam, of course. I think patient concerns that I would want, if I was going to see my doctor, is one, how much exercise should I get? What should be my ideal body weight? If there's a strong family history of this, how should I be screened? What are some simple over-the-counter medicines? Do I need to take any vitamins, supplements? Those are the kinds of questions that I would be asking in general, yes.
What about just medication in general? Is the ultimate goal to make sure that people use the medication they need, no more or no less than they need, or is the ultimate goal to let's find a way to get to a point where you don't need to use any medication at all?
I think that would be the goal. And intrinsically, if you look at all the people who have lived long, have lived only on an aspirin or a Tylenol. I think most patients assume that a doctor's visit to an office is not complete without a prescription. If you don't get a prescription coming out of a doctor's office, it means the doctor hasn't done his job. But I think a lot of the doctor's job as a primary care physician particularly is reassurance and reinforcement. If it's possible to come off the medications, yes, absolutely. I think as physicians, we tend to overprescribe, and the goal would be to keep it as simple and as minimal as possible.
We've been talking about the need to have a regular physical, but the thought occurs to me, and we talked about this off air before the show began, that men have this tendency not to come in to the office until there is a problem, right?
That is true, and that's because, I guess as a species, we are stubborn. And I don't believe we can do much about it. That is true. I think several studies have shown that men in general tend to pursue health care less often. Women, on average, live 3 to 5 years longer than men. And over several decades, this has been shown to be consistently true. Men are likely to tough out an illness. They give possibly more priorities to work over treatment and rest. They're reluctant about discussing their health, and they don't realize that their doctors are there for prevention and can discuss age-appropriate screening too, and they don't go till it's too late at times. And I think the biggest thing also is I think women in general at a younger age start contraception and pap smears and have an established physician with their gynecologist, whereas men, until you're 40 or have a reason to go to a physician, don't have that relationship starting at a young age, so they don't take care of themselves as well as women do.
Finally, what's the single most important thing that men can do to maintain good physical health? If you narrowed it down to one thing, what would it be?
Exercise.
I have to say, this is the first time I've asked this kind of question many, many times before. And every time I've asked a doctor, they always go straight to don't smoke. This is the first time somebody gave me a different answer. I'm grateful for it.
Don't smoke, yes, true, but I think exercise.
Okay, so there it is. Dr. Sumukh Sundaram is an MD from Christie Clinic in Champaign. Dr. Sundaram, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Greg.
And we welcome any additional thoughts that you may have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. If you know anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus but lives outside of our listening area, let them know we stream the program live every day at will.illinois.edu. That is the same place where you can listen back to past programs. Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up again, visit the Focus page of our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. And remember that you can hear this program twice every weekday, live weekday mornings at 10 a.m. and then repeated weeknights at 8 p.m. on WILL AM 580. On tomorrow's program, we will discuss women in combat. Last week, the Obama administration moved to open more military positions, including ground combat units, to women, a move President Obama called another historic step towards harnessing the talents and skills of all of our citizens. Women have been in combat. That part is not new, not on necessarily such a large scale. We will talk with Erica Borgren, director of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs, about what last week's move suggests and what the experience of military service is like for women today. That's in the first half of tomorrow's program. Then in the second half, we will talk with Elizabeth Ambrose, a veteran Navy corpsman, and student at the University of Illinois about adjusting to civilian life after a career in the military. We'll also talk with Nicholas Osborne, Assistant Dean of Students in the Office of Veteran Student Support Services. That's on tomorrow's program. On Thursday, we'll turn our attention to immigration, and we'll talk about it both at the state level and at the national level, as there are developments legislatively towards immigration in terms of driver's licenses and also in terms of moving towards citizenship. Then on Friday, a conversation about the future of space exploration. That's what we have in store the rest of the week on Focus. Today's show is produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. He handled your calls. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.